Hello and welcome to Making Risk Better, a podcast series produced in partnership with AIG. With a panel of security risk experts, we'll discuss the impact of conflict, kidnapping, piracy, and terrorism on global business. Our host is Dr. Alessandro Arduino, Principal Research Fellow at the Middle East Institute, National University of Singapore, whose two decades of experience in China encompasses security analysis and crisis management.
Welcome to the second episode of Making Risk Better. I'm your host, Alessandro Arduino, and today we are going to talk about piracy. And in my personal opinion, we have a dream team of experts. I'm very glad to have with us Adrian Di Pasquale, Tim Lambon, and from our first episode, Richard Nilon. Talking about pirate, the first thing that comes to my mind is the movie Pirates of the Caribbean, with Captain Jack Sparrow asking, why is the rum gone? And it linked to a common perception that pirates are a relic from the past. And also we share a quite diffuse romantic view on piracy. Even Steve Jobs was caught mentioning that it's more fun to be a pirate than joining the Navy. While he was hiring staff for the early Mac development team, he was very explicit looking for pirates, meaning someone that think different. Unfortunately, piracy on the IC remains a very real problem. It's on the rise and is not romantic at all. In recent years, seafarers have been killed and abducted, and vessels have been hijacked for ransom. To counter this plague, since 2019, an international task force, the Combined Task Force 151, was set up to combat piracy near Somalia and the Gulf of Aden, reducing basically piratical activity almost to zero. However, during the last 5 years, on the other side of Africa, in the Gulf of Guinea, piracy is still a clear and present danger. So I would like to start with Adrian. Adrian, as you are the head of crisis solution, Asia Pacific, and head of management liability for AIG, and definitely an expert in managing risk in dangerous water, let's say in the middle of the night, you receive a telephone call and someone from your area, the Asia Pacific, is just telling you that their commercial vessel has been hijacked near West Africa. And always these calls are in the middle of the night. So what's your first reaction?
Alex, that's always true. Those calls always come through at the most inappropriate times in the evening. You know, what's important to remember is when I receive calls like that is I actually don't know what's happened. So the first thing I'm always asking is, have the crisis consultants been activated? Because these are individuals with expertise in their fields of crisis management. And what they're able to do is provide best practice advice to our clients and our insureds of what to do for those first 24 hours whilst an event's happened. In that time, they'll obviously go and deploy people to the locations, but we need to make sure that people are as prepared as they can be and managing the situation as best they can. Secondly, I ask for a triage, what's happened? Because I need to know, as the insurer, what's happened, where it's happened in the Gulf of Guinea, and I can start liaising with people internally, our claims people, our underwriters, letting people know what's happened, finding information, making sure the vessels are actually insured, and communicating it to their insurance brokers or other people who need to be made aware of these things. Some of these things can be done quite quickly, you know, if they can be done remotely. Others will require me to go into the office and check through files just to make sure everything is where it needs to be.
Thank you very much, Adrian. And just give me the chance to introduce Tim Lambon. Tim is the director for Special Risk Response for Crisis 24. Tim spent 5 years with Rhodesian Forces and the next 25 years as an international journalist specializing in war reporting. As a journalist, he covered almost every type of conflict, from the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in 1979 to the Lebanese crisis in 2006. Tim, placing armed guard on vessel can have different effect. Both if the armed guard are PMC, private military companies, or the Navy. So in your opinion, this is going to promote or constrain the threat of piracy, and especially if we are looking at Nigerian waters?
Thanks very much. Well, the interesting thing about the Nigerian waters is that it's not just the Nigerian waters. There's Benin, Togo, Ghana, etc. There's a whole lot of legacies from the colonial period where those waters extend down. They all have a small slice of the Gulf of Guinea, and then there is a central section of international waters. And all of these countries have legislation which disallows private companies or private individuals from carrying weapons, and particularly foreigners. So the only way that you can actually get an armed guard on a vessel is to hire them from the Navy. And indeed, the Nigerian Navy is making millions out of hiring these armed guards to place on vessels, but they only go within the Nigerian waters. Once they get to the edge of the Nigerian waters, then they either leave the vessel and return back to Nigeria, or they definitely have to get off of the vessel if they've been on the vessel itself. So what the pirates have been doing is, over the years since 2009 to 2011, when this piracy first started, is that they have been getting further and further offshore. And now they have very sophisticated logistics operations which allow them to refuel at sea and keep their vessels right out on that edge. So just where the armed guards are leaving the vessels, that's where the pirates are now operating. And that is where the navies come in.
Adrian, Tim just mentioned the private guard, but there are also other means that don't involve kinetic action, and something that from an issuer point of view you suggest.
That's true, Alex. Looking at any risk which has armed guards on board, these vessels are going to be some of the best ones from a risk mitigation and management point of view. But there are other types of preventative measures that boat owners and crews can take to mitigate the act of piracy. Things like using razor wire, high-pressure hoses, armed guards, as we've mentioned, even basically having things like a citadel on board, traveling in convoys with other vessels as well to have a safety in numbers, so to say.
Tim, finding a vessel in the middle of international water is not so easy. Refueling your vessel in the middle of the ocean is not so easy. How would they carry on this kind of operation?
Well, there's always been conspiracy theories about how much background research they do on vessels that are actually transiting the area. Do they actually look at vessel tracking systems and say, okay, there's a vessel of such and such a tonnage with this kind of freeboard coming through, we're going to go and intercept that? The fact that we know that they operate in an area for up to 2 or 3 weeks at a time indicates that they don't have that kind of intelligence. Now, one of the major regions that they predate is actually the roads, because these ports along the West African coast are quite small. And so you often get a number of vessels waiting in the roads, ready to go in and discharge or to reload. And while they are waiting at anchor is one of the most vulnerable times for when the pirates can actually attack and take these vessels.
Adrian, we just talked about intelligence from a piratical side of the equation, but then also there are choke points. I mean, maritime choke point where vessels have no chance. They have to go to cross that area. So can you tell to our audience a little bit more about maritime choke point? And also, are we dealing with one kind of piracy or there are different kind of pirates?
A choke point really is where we have a whole lot of vessels, you know, major shipping traffic being funneled through a very small area in geography, being it, say, between Indonesia and Singapore, be between Yemen or Somalia. And that's really causing a large area for pirates to concentrate and attack on. It's really like having a bit of a traffic jam when you're going on and off the freeway. There are two main ones we think about in the world, you know, one in my part of the world being the Singapore Straits, where essentially all maritime traffic going from China or Asia through to Europe needs to go through this very small area between Singapore and Indonesia. Second and probably the most commonly known one is the area around the Gulf of Aden, so the area between Yemen and Somalia, which has been quite known for pirates. At the same time, there's Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, that area between Oman and Iran. With regards to types of piracy, my personal opinion is there's really three types. We can sort of have our politically motivated piracy, our economically motivated and while similar to the latter, more of a of official corruption. So the former looking for more about seizure of people in order to make a statement. The second, looking to seize people and ransom them off, or to seize people whilst they then take anything on board the vessel, the cargo, things that aren't bolted down. And these can be either professional or disorganized or ad hoc criminals.
Moving from this and shifting back the narrative to Nigeria, Tim, I just mentioned before briefly that the Common Task Force 151 was extremely efficient in fighting piracy near Somalia. And now there is an ongoing operation, the Operation Deep Blue, in proximity of Gulf of Guinea. In your opinion, the presence of international naval vessel is going to change the situation?
So Deep Blue is actually a cooperation between the countries of West Africa and international forces to try and suppress piracy. A lot of equipment and a lot of assistance has been given to the countries of West Africa that have coasts on the Gulf of Guinea. Whether that equipment ever gets used very efficiently or whether it just rots, the corruption is huge and the training is very poor. And so the exercise of those resources, I think, is limited. However, as I just spoke about previously, with these edges of the national waters, and the international waters between, that's where the international navies operate. One of the problems with international navies is that they have a limited mandate when it actually comes to combating the pirates. And I have to take a bit of an issue with you. You said that 151 was very efficient in the Indian Ocean in suppressing Somali piracy. I don't believe it was. I believe that the Somali piracy actually came down in September of 2011 because the seamen's unions decided that they would no longer oppose the placing of armed guards on the vessels. And once armed guards had been put on those vessels, they had stable platforms from which they could fire at small vessels, the skiffs that were being used by the pirates that were going up and down and sideways. And it is my understanding, or my belief rather, that a significant number of the pirates who used to do the boardings in the Indian Ocean were taken out and never reported, because the reporting, although anybody was supposed to report any contact, why would you? You're out, people are trying to pirate your vessel. And so these guys were taken out of the picture, and then the pirates just went, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. And piracy just dropped off a ledge. And that, to a large degree, I think, is what is happening now in the Gulf of Guinea. We've got these armed guards that are being put on board from the Navy in Nigeria, and also the international navies operating in the international waters in the Gulf of Guinea. And that really has suppressed the number of piracy incidents in the last about a year.
But now, Tim, I'm very intrigued. You mentioned boarding. I mean, from a skiff in high sea, boarding a vessel is everything except easy. Even shooting to a vessel with an RPG or with a Kalashnikov can be a daunting task. Do you think that is something that become very specialized among pirates in Somalia, or everybody can try to do that?
No, indeed. So an interesting thing is that it seems that the freeboard of a vessel is no guarantee against pirates actually coming on board. But interestingly, in the Somali piracies, a lot of the time the vessels were forced to stop. And once they had stopped, they're a very much easier target to get onto. Now, why did they stop? Because the masters of those vessels were afraid when they saw an RPG-7, a rocket-propelled grenade, being waved at them. And so they brought their vessels to a halt. And that was only because they didn't understand that an RPG-7 can actually do very little damage to a vessel of the kind of size that we're talking about. It blows a small hole, probably only about 6 or 8 inches across. And yes, if you're standing on the other side of it, that's going to be bad news. But it's not going to sink the vessel. And actually, what you should do is just keep the thing full throttle and move from side to side as much as possible. Now, just a bit of experience. I worked for Greenpeace at one stage. And as a cameraman on small dinghies for Greenpeace, I had to try and focus on vessels in the distance. Now, that is very similar to firing a weapon. And I can tell you that it's extremely difficult and takes a lot of practice. And then also we would be boarding vessels from these dinghies. And it takes a lot of courage, I have to say. And I think that there were probably very few actual pirates that did the boardings, because we know that the pirates were broken up into different groups. There would be the boarding party, there would be the party that then sailed the vessel back to the coast, and then there would be the guarding party who looked after the vessel and the crew while the ransom was being negotiated. And I really do believe that the boarding parties who were so specialized were few and were taken out by the armed guards once the armed guards were allowed onto the vessels.
On this theme, I don't think I've read many reports. It's very specific, but this kind of intelligence is very timely, especially when a company prepare risk prevention. Adrian, what do you think in this respect? What just Tim said, knowing that you just need to keep your vessel going, is a kind of information that you provide to your client or you have discussion with them about this kind of experience that just Tim mentioned?
Of course, look, most maritime companies know what the BMP, so the best maritime practices are, both for the East Coast of Africa and in the West Coast too. So from a risk perspective, we love to see when people say, okay, our vessels are compliant, our crew are trained, they know what the best things to do are. So when we see something like that, you know, to us, that's a much better risk to look at.
And as Tim mentioned before, there is already a lot of money moving around. You just mentioned the money allocated to the Navy to provide security. But then we can talk now with Richard, who is our expert on paying kidnapping and ransom, about ransom payment. Richard Nilon is the head of Complex Environment Team, an international law firm, HFW. He's very well known in the industry as the go-to lawyer for handling difficult problems that arise when ship, cargo, crew are hijacked or even kidnapped. He also has been involved in staggering number of hijacking to resolve this problem, over 130 hijacking and securing the release of over 1,800 hostages. And mostly he handled out more than 70% of the all commercial vessel hijacking by Somali pirates. And I'm sure, Richard, now you are dealing with a lot of cases in West Africa. But I want to ask you another number. There is a lot of cash moving around for ransom payment. Can you give us, let's say, a ballpark figure about this number?
Thank you, Alex, and thank you for that introduction. Yes, I mean, there has been large payments of ransom being made over the years, both in Somalia and both in West Africa as well. And that figure probably exceeds several hundred million dollars. Typically, those payments are made in cash. Typically, those payments are made in United States dollars cash. Sometimes I'm asked, you know, do you always pay cash? Can you pay in other means? Sometimes crypto is raised as a possible payment. We do pay ransoms in crypto in other arenas, in other sectors. We have the capability to do so. However, in my experience in West Africa, the pirates remain pretty unsophisticated. They want to see the money. They want to eyeball the money. They want something tangible to share out. They want something tangible in exchange for releasing the hostages, the people in the group that they're in. They want to see the money. And it's very difficult to explain a wire transfer, but it's very difficult to explain a crypto payment. So typically, yes, it's always cash and typically US dollars.
Oh, it's quite interesting because you mentioned the sophistication of the pirates. So I think when you received the first request for ransom, if it's something like a stable coin or a tethered crypto value, it also means that you are dealing with someone that is more sophisticated, and also there will be an issue about the price at the end, how much you can try to negotiate with them. Is this the case?
Well, certainly in cyber extortion, demanding crypto is very common, and in other arenas as well. In hostage taking, it does happen, but certainly in West Africa, I mean, I probably deal with the majority of West African hijackings, piracy hijackings, and we've never had a crypto demand yet. I mean, the issue of whether they want cryptocurrency, but also the choreography that's required if you're paying a ransom in crypto. You know, normally there's a physical handover cash for people. If you're paying in crypto, it has its challenges. And where we do pay ransoms in crypto, we need to be aware that firstly, the same regulatory piece needs to be resolved. You know, we're dealing with financial institutions and we need to explain what we're doing. We need to explain that it's perfectly lawful, in our opinion, in this particular situation to pay a ransom. And the other thing with crypto, of course, as we know, as we've seen very recently, it fluctuates and it can fluctuate at very short notice. So if you are going to pay in crypto, you need to be very clear with the counterparty, you know, when you're going to purchase that crypto, at what rate you're going to purchase it, and if it fluctuates, at whose risk that is. Now, if you're dealing with sophisticated counterparties who understand crypto, that's fine. If you're dealing with West African pirates and you need to explain currency fluctuations, you know, it's very, very tricky. So at the moment, certainly what we see is the demands in West Africa are cash and typically US dollars cash.
Tim, from your side, working from Somali pirate to West Africa pirate, we just talk about sophistication and means of payment. Do you have something to add on this?
Yes, I was just going to say that the interesting thing, particularly in the Gulf of Guinea, is that it is one of the only times in kidnapping, and we deal with 130 cases a year of all sorts of extortion exploits. It's the only time in kidnapping, pretty much, where you actually have what we call a simultaneous exchange. In other words, the money is taken. The pirates look at the money. They count the money. Might not count the entire lot, but they will give it a good looking over to make sure that the bulk is there, and then they will release the kidnapped victims to the same boat that has actually delivered the ransom. Which is not what happens. It might happen in the movies, but it doesn't happen in most kidnappings. There's always a period when they have the ransom, and the kidnapped victims are released sometime later. And I was just going to say that we have actually had one demand for crypto, but it wasn't very serious. We got the impression that the guys had heard about crypto. They thought, well, let's throw this into the mix. And all we said to them was, no, we can't deal in crypto. And they never mentioned it again. So it wasn't a serious demand at all.
And Richard, Tim just mentioned, again, Gulf of Guinea. And recently, if I read correctly in the press, Nigeria has banned payment of ransom. Is that right?
Yeah, this has been in the press quite recently. Nigeria enacted the Terrorism Prevention and Prohibition Act 2022, and that became law on the 12th of May 2022. So very recently, and there's been quite a few articles in the press about that. It did come as a surprise that that Act was actually enacted. There was quite a lot of opposition to it within Nigeria, but it was rushed through the Senate, rushed through the House of Representatives, and received assent and became law. Now, obviously, legislation that's clear and assists law enforcement with prosecuting and eradicating terrorism or piracy is always to be welcomed. I think the danger is that what we sometimes find is that certain acts also damage or prevent or harm our ability to assist the victims of those crimes. As I say, there's been plenty of articles in the press saying the effect of the new legislation is to ban ransom payments. My response to that is, you know, seek legal advice. This is a very complex area. There are very serious criminal penalties if the law is contravened. The statement that ransoms have been banned, in my view, is an inaccurate oversimplification. But there is a new piece of legislation. It creates new offences. It has new definitions. And it's going to take a little bit of time for everyone on the ground to reach an understanding of its implications. It's something we've been working on quite a lot recently in order to reassure those in the industries that we still have a solution to secure the release of seafarer hostages kidnapped by criminal gangs in Nigeria. But any change in legislation comes with uncertainty. It's going to take a little bit of time for that uncertainty to be ironed out.
Adrian, Richard just underlined two that looks contradictory thing, and I do believe it will be dangerous water for you two to navigate. The need of duty of care, assisting victim, but also at the same time penalties in doing so if you do it in the wrong way. And we are talking serious stuff like terrorism financing.
And look, that's why, as part of any insurance program, you do have abilities to engage with legal counsel. From an insurer perspective, we want to make sure that everything we do, everything we are supporting, is done through legitimate means, is abiding by all required laws, both locally and internationally, as they need to be. And again, yeah, everything is above board. From a duty of care perspective, a policy helps as well by enabling employers to look after not only the individual after they've been released from captivity, but also looking after their family as well to make sure that everyone is best placed after the event.
Now I have a question for all the three of you. And basically, I'm looking to see what is your suggestion to organizations that must embrace risk contingency planning. What are the best practices in your opinion? Richard, let's start with you.
Sure. Some terms have been mentioned today, best management practices, planning, contingency planning. Look, any solid organization needs a contingency plan. The reality is that there's people and people on this call that have resolved a large number of kidnappings and piracy incidents over the years. There ought not to be many surprises when these kind of things happen. Yes, it's a very difficult case to deal with. Yes, all cases are different, but there is a tried and tested mechanism using professionals, people like Tim, people like us, in terms of resolving these things. And it's far better to have those plans in place to understand the team that's going to respond to those incidents when it happens, to trial that, to test that, to make sure that when that time comes, when that incident comes, we have a plan in place and there's not panic and there's a sensible way to have those issues resolved.
Tim, one sentence, what is the best practice in risk contingency planning?
Have insurance. Make sure that you have a kidnap management or crisis management plan and exercise it regularly. And if you can, make sure that there are armed guards on your vessel.
Thank you for that. Adrian, your take.
I would say that insurance is there for those unforeseen circumstances and events. No one expects their vessels to be pirated, but it's always nice to know that you can pick up the phone and call someone like myself, call someone like Tim, and there'll be people there to help you.
Thank you, Adrian, Tim, and Richard. And now our last member of the Dream Team, our guest expert from the Royal United Service Institute, better known as Rusi. She is going to tell us about the future of piracy. It's a pleasure to welcome Virle Nowens, Senior Research Fellow in International Security Study at RUSI. So, Virle, looking at the development in the global geopolitical landscape, where do you see the greatest risk of piracy spreading or intensifying in the next coming years?
I think that's a really great question, Alex. I think to really understand this question or what the answer to this question is, you've got to kind of understand the drivers of piracy. So maritime piracy and armed robbery at sea is often driven by phenomena on land and can be anything really from poverty among specific coastal communities to domestic conflicts, as well as I think generally poor governance or, for example, weak law enforcement, both on land or at sea, or the jointness of those two. I think what we've seen is that land-based sources of piracy and armed robbery at sea, for example, in the Horn of Africa and the Gulf of Guinea, were strongly driven by these factors. In Southeast Asia, we've seen, of course, additional factors that have been driving maritime piracy, which have included, for example, radical, politically motivated groups engaging in criminal activity, such as kidnapped for ransom in the Sulu and Celebeses, as well as other drivers, such as the impact of illegal fishing on coastal communities. And so I think when we look at piracy moving forwards in the coming decade or so, we should be really looking at these littoral areas where we can anticipate severe poverty, where food security, as I mentioned, through the depletion of fish stocks due to overfishing and poor management, and other human security issues are worsening, and where coastal and maritime law enforcement is relatively weak. And I think this counts for where we could also be seeing domestic political conflicts spilling out onto coasts, for example, with displaced populations that then ultimately fall further into poverty. And if we think about it this way, then I think there's quite a few different areas where this could be anticipated. Certainly in areas where we've already seen piracy be a problem in the past, be that in Southeast Asia, be that in the Gulf of Guinea or on the East African, North and East African coast. But if we see other areas falling into some of those categories that I've mentioned as potential drivers, then those are areas to watch.
No, Verily, it's very important you mentioned the littoral area, because food security in the going years is going to be definitely a very serious problem, as climate change is going to exacerbate the already very difficult situation of several parts of the world. But given the rising geopolitical tension and the other security preoccupation, in your opinion, how much reliance can be placed on ongoing multilateral effort to combat piracy?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. You know, at a time when we have the ongoing war in Ukraine, when governments are under economic pressure, and of course, where countries are concerned around other geopolitical areas of competition, there might be a risk that there's no political will, or that political will to continue to resource these initiatives dwindles. But we have seen really important examples of multilateral cooperation, for example, in Africa and Asia. There is, of course, Operation Atalanta around the Horn of Africa. There's the EU's Cremario program in the Western Indian Ocean, which established greater maritime awareness and information exchange capabilities in the region. There's a coordinated maritime presences program in the Gulf of Guinea, which ensures a European continued and rotational patrol presence. And in Asia, you've got initiatives between regional countries, trilateral, quadrilateral initiatives, for example, in the Sulu Celibacies and the Straits of Malacca and Singapore, where you see joint patrols at sea and in the air, and also information exchange. And I think these types of efforts have had a real impact. If you look at reporting around the number of incidents of piracy and armed robbery at sea last year, the International Chamber of Commerce's International Maritime Bureau's Piracy Reporting Center reported that last year we saw the lowest level of incidents reported since 1994. But I think, you know, we must keep in mind that these types of efforts are temporary fixes. And so if you are to remove these multilateral efforts and presences at sea, then piracy is likely to return. But I do think we're seeing things move in the right direction, despite all these other short-term and other immediate priorities, of course. I think there's an awareness that these measures are temporary fixes, so to speak, and that the threat at sea continues. And I think that there's an awareness, you know, at a time that our economies are struggling, that taking your focus off anti-piracy measures allows the resurgence of piracy, and that this will have a direct and negative impact on international maritime trade. And in geopolitical terms, when we see European, American, and other like-minded partners be quite concerned around some of China's behavior at sea and involvement in maritime security around the world, I think not engaging in anti-piracy missions or maritime patrols gives an opportunity for China to engage more in this, whether that be through China's PLA Navy extending its influence and reach, or whether it be around China having the opportunity to become a greater leader in maritime governance, as well as for, of course, the still small but growing role of the Chinese private maritime security company industry, which my research has shown is quite active in the Indian Ocean region already, and which seems to at least purport to offer armed escort services. So if anything, I think this further complicates the geopolitical competition that some countries at least are already concerned with. So that's good news. I think it's also great that Atalanta was extended at least until December 2022. We see the EU's initiatives, be that the Combined Maritime Presence Initiative or Cremario, being extended as well in geographic remit, at least in the case of the latter. And there's a host of new initiatives that seek to also address maritime insecurity at its wider scope. So all in all, I think there is a concern that political will must continue to focus on this issue, but we see, I think, positive movements ahead.
Thank you very much, Virla. We start the podcast talking about pirates and fiction, and I realize that reality surpass fiction. You mentioned, and it's very important, that there is a need for political will that is not only related to a short-term problem, but to a long-term structural problem. So it's not only important that these combined maritime initiative are going to go on in the coming months and in the coming year, but also there is an increased awareness and an increased role of the private security sector. So thank you again, Virle, for being with us. Thank you, Adrian, Tin, and Richard for your very timely contribution. And to our audience, thank you and goodbye.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast series are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of American International Group, Inc., or its subsidiaries or affiliates, AIG. Any content provided by our speakers are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything. AIG makes no representations as to accuracy, completeness, correctness, or validity of any information provided during this podcast series and will not be liable for any errors, omissions, or delays in this information, or any losses, injuries, or damages arising from its use.